And certainly the world that we live in doesn't want the idea of judgment at all. I think that's one of the reasons why, I mean, very simply, that evolution is an extremely popular doctrine is if we are the product of accident, if we're the product of just things banging into each other and here's life and we just can't explain things too well, there is no God. And if there's no God, there's no judgment. And it's kind of simple that way. We live our lives, we argue with each other, and we live and let live, and then we die, and it's just the way it is. We die, and we're done. There's no judgment. If there is judgment, it's just from other people, and that doesn't really matter. But the Bible, which, the more you think about it, is our Creator's manual toward all of mankind. It's not a rule book for some people and not for others. It is what God intends for everyone to know. If you look at Hebrews 11:3, I mean, that's the point, that God created everything and He has given instruction. He framed the worlds and He framed our lives, our very existence. And so tonight what I want to talk about for a few minutes is the judgment that matters. Because we live in a very strange time. I say strange, it's not a lot different than it's been since mankind has been on the earth, where, you know, we judge things that we hear about. Except that nowadays, with social media, we have an input and we get input. So I sometimes forget you can put something out. Twitter's kind of fun, where you tweet, you know, you put a statement out there. I've used this as an example before to just make a statement. I love oranges. And then people will like it, or people will turn right around and vilify you. What, you hate bananas? What's wrong with mangoes? Pineapples, you got a problem with that? You just made a positive statement that you like something, and other people get really upset because there are a lot of people who just want to be upset. I've kind of learned that the hard way. It doesn't matter what you say. It doesn't even matter how you say it. People are going to be angry and complain. Now, that's kind of an innocuous example, but when you get into politics or you get into religion, people really get into it and are fervent and sometimes so rude that I've tried to illustrate it this way with somebody. I was having a little bit of an argument. They're like, "You're going to block me?" I said, "Yeah, I am," because the way I think of this is someone who knocks on my door, I don't know who they are, really don't want to open up to them, and then they burst into my house and start screaming at me. I don't want them in there. I want them out of my house. I don't need that stress. So this is an easy way of you not being in my house and me just, you know, not having to deal with it anymore. And it might be a little bit of a cop-out, but it's the world in which we live. I don't mind doing that. I've put things on Facebook that I've had other friends who are not Christians. I don't have very many, honestly, but I do have some who get really upset. Maybe not at what I've said, but what other friends have said. I just start cleaning it up. I just start deleting comments left and right because, you know what, it's my page, not your page, it's mine. And that's just kind of my basic philosophy with some of those things. The easiest thing to do is what my brother does, which is just stay off of a lot of it. He's not off all of it. I think he's on Facebook and that's it. But I don't mind trying to talk to people. I think I've had some good discussions with people. More recently with the Southern Baptist Convention in Dallas, I mentioned that recently, that they're having a huge debate and they really are divided over women being elders because they have a new president who was voted in who said, in his opinion, and that's what it is, his opinion, women should be able to serve because some women do have the gift of leadership. Well, the others who don't agree with him are like, I thought it was an office. It's not a gift. So they're arguing over gift or office of elder. And I'm like, 1 Timothy 3:1 says, any man who aspires to the office of an elder, he aspires to a good work. And so not only do we have a gender-specific any man, but we also have office, very clearly in that passage. And I've had a few who've written to me saying they just didn't know it was there. I've had some say, well, maybe that's not what the word means, because they don't want it to mean office. It has to mean gift, because that's what they believe. My point is, you can argue well, and do so as I think a Christian should. Even if you're talking to somebody face-to-face, you want to be respectful. 2 Timothy 2 reminds us that the servant of the Lord must be able to teach in gentleness. That doesn't mean we're always successful, but that's what we should strive for. I know in our political ways now that we don't want people judging us harshly, and we really shouldn't be judging others harshly. But this is the thing. It's all about don't judge me. You can't judge me. You don't know this. You don't know that. And they're right. But I think more so it's the attitude of you can't judge me. Well, Jesus said in John 7:24, a passage we'll probably be looking at here in a minute, he is telling the Jews there that they need to judge things. And he tells them, judge righteous judgment. He doesn't tell them, don't judge. Judging is horrible. Why would you judge? God doesn't judge. He doesn't say anything stupid like that. He says, judge righteous judgment. The passage most everybody knows, and I have this quoted to me maybe once every other week or so, is Matthew 7, verse 1. Judge not, lest you be judged. Well, if you have your Bible with you, let's look at the rest of that context, Matthew 7, 1 through 6. And by the way, this is a Sermon on the Mount passage. Matthew chapters 5, 6, 7 are the Sermon on the Mount, so this is not spoken only to his apostles, as you know, you have John 13 through 17. This is specifically to an entire multitude of people. And he tells them all, after he says, don't worry about anything, verse 34 of chapter 6, he then goes on, judge not that you be not judged. For with the judgment you use or you pronounce, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, or the standard you use, it'll be measured to you. So why do you seek the speck in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that's in your own? This is kind of funny. I don't think Jesus is intending to be funny, but there is something here that is really funny. A guy who has a speck in his eye, he's blinking really badly, watering, and you're like, oh man, I'm going to go help him, as you have a 2x4 sticking out of your head, right? You're going to go help this guy with a speck while you got a 2x4. Well, I don't think at all Jesus intended this other than just a hyperbole to get them to remember this. How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when there's a log in your own? Verse 5, Jesus says, you hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. But I want you to notice, he doesn't say, why are you worried about his speck? Take out the log of your own eye and leave him alone completely. He doesn't say that. He says, take the log out of your own eye, you hypocrite, and then you can see to take the speck out of his eye. He doesn't tell us, don't try to be worried about another person's speck. And then he says this in verse 6, don't give to dogs what is holy. Do not throw pearls before swine, lest they trample them underfoot and they turn to attack you. You don't take something of that kind of value. You wouldn't take a pearl necklace and put it around the neck of a pig. They don't know what it is. They would tear the thing up. They would trample it. It would be ruined. It would be destroyed. It would be gone. And I think sometimes we need to learn that lesson when we talk to some people, that they don't want the truth. They don't love the truth. They have no desire for what God has said. What did Jesus tell his apostles? When you go from one city to another and they don't receive you, remember the son of Boanerges, James and John said, do you want us to call down fire now? And Jesus doesn't say yes. He says, you don't realize what you're saying here. You just need to move on to the next town. And he tells his apostles, shake the dust off your feet. He doesn't say, you need to vilify these people. You need to point the finger in their face. You need to make it harder. He just says, shake the dust off. Move on. And I think sometimes we would just be really wise to do that. Like he says in verse 6, don't give to dogs what's holy. Don't throw your pearls before swine. Well, in John 7, 23, 24, what I was mentioning earlier when Jesus says, you know, judge righteous judgment. Verse 23, if on the Sabbath a man receives circumcision so that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because on the Sabbath I made a whole man well? I know I'm misreading this. Are you angry with me because on the Sabbath I made a man's whole body well? You know, very often the Pharisees and the scribes went after Jesus because of what he did on the Sabbath. And I think purposefully, Jesus did things on the Sabbath because it wasn't just to aggravate them, but it was really to teach them that, as he says, the man was not made for the Sabbath. Sabbath was made for man. Sabbath is designed by God to bring us in a closer relationship to God, not man serving Sabbath. That's what Jesus said. So in John 7, that context, it's not don't judge at all. He doesn't tell them you shouldn't be judging anything. He says do not judge by appearances. What do we do? I mean, it was what they were doing. They were judging on the appearance of things. They're angry with Jesus for doing a work on the Sabbath day without thinking about what is this work? This work was healing a man physically, his whole body. He did it on the Sabbath, so the Jews judged by appearances. And he says, don't judge by appearances. Judge with righteous judgment. You need to think about this. And that's what we need to do too. It's don't judge at all. That's not what he says. He doesn't say don't judge at all, ever. He says judge with righteous judgment. So like in Romans 14, in the context, Paul is talking about judging each other over our opinions. And I know we don't really have, I'm going to say this as a qualified statement. I don't believe we have anything that's exactly like the things they dealt with in over foods. I don't know that we have dietary restrictions that we really focus on societally even. I mean, I know there are a few things we probably just don't like to eat. I don't really like broccoli, but I would never think someone sins because they're eating broccoli. Well, in the time of Romans 14, there were Jews who definitely, because of Leviticus 11, had that clear Mosaic law influence to not eat certain foods. They just couldn't because that's the way the law spoke. Well, the law had been replaced by a new covenant. Jesus nailed it to the cross. And maybe intellectually they could say yes, but they probably still had a hard time eating anything that had been offered to an idol. You know, Paul deals with that even with the Corinthians, the Gentile Corinthians. And he tells them, look, you should not eat anything that's offered to an idol, but not because of your own conscience, but because of other people. They don't know that you don't know, or rather, they don't know that you do know, that there is nothing. An idol is nothing. So they would go to places where they would indulge themselves sexually. They would indulge themselves with all the foods they wanted to eat. That was part of their idolatrous worship. So they really had a struggle with this. And Paul says, the people who won't eat meat, don't judge the ones who do, and vice versa. They're both serving their masters. So I don't know exactly where we'd go with that. It might be examples that I've heard that are probably close enough. Those who recognize Christmas as a holiday, not necessarily the birthday of Jesus, put up Christmas trees and things like that. Okay. There are those who I think are very wise. I know when I was growing up, we did it sometimes and didn't do it sometimes. As a kid, it was a little confusing. But my dad would tell us, look, our neighbor's Catholic. We're not putting up a Christmas tree. And it wasn't because of us. It was because of them. They didn't know that we knew that it was not Jesus' birthday. And I remember we had discussions with them, but we still never did it as long as they were our neighbors or we were their neighbors. And then there were other places we lived. We didn't really have neighbors, you know, living out somewhere. And sometimes they would go ahead and do it. You know, I didn't feel one way or the other. It was a matter of opinion. Our opinions can get us in trouble sometimes. We can really fight, I was going to say the word vociferously. I don't know where that came from, but we can fight hard on it, vehemently. Their opinions. And don't pass judgment on your brother because you shouldn't do it. That's what Paul says. Why do you pass judgment on your brother? Or you, why do you despise your brother? We will all stand before the judgment seat of God. Our judgment against each other when it comes to these opinions doesn't matter. We're all going to stand before the judgment seat of God. It is written, as I live, says the Lord, every knee is going to bow to me, every tongue shall confess to God. So then each of us will give an account of himself to God. Okay. Matters of opinion, we're not going to be arguing about that to that point. But at the same time, we need to, like Paul says to the Thessalonians, flee the appearance of evil. 1 Thessalonians 5, he mentions that. there are things that appear evil. He says that we should stay away from all that. That requires judgment. 2 Corinthians 5, passage we use this morning, verses 8 through 11, a little bit larger context where Paul says we are of good courage and we would rather be away from the body and with the Lord. So whether we are at home or away, we make it our aim to please Him. For the reason is we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ so that each one may receive what is done for what he's done in the body, whether good or evil. Which means there are things that are good and there are things that are evil. Therefore, understanding the fear of the Lord, we persuade others. We are trying to convince others. Not because of what we think. And I think that's one thing we can try to do is we try to have discussions with people over maybe some very serious issues. You know, it may be an email. It may be in a broader way on Twitter where everybody can see this and everyone can come at you. I mean, I've had discussions that I thought were going pretty well until some Yahoo, who I don't know that anybody knows the guy, says, in the middle of a discussion about religion, there is no God. In the middle of it all. And I'm like, I ignore the guy. I just don't want to get into it with him. I mean, there are things I want to say, but then it's like it's not pertinent to the main thing that I have going on here. That's the problem with that particular platform. But there are other platforms. You delete the statement and move on, you know? And I like that a little bit better. But still, my point is that we want to represent as best we can what Jesus is actually saying. A couple years ago, I was having a discussion. I don't want to use the word argument. It was an argument, but it was a discussionary argument. And as we were talking, he and I, back and forth, I didn't think about the platform not being a private thing. It was on Facebook, and I had a couple other friends chime in. Well, I kept deleting their comments because they weren't really helping. They were stoking the fire, you know, fire of anger. So finally, I wrote them privately and said, look, I'm going to move this discussion off Facebook because you guys aren't helping. And just trying to be honest with them. And they're like, well, what's wrong with what we're saying? I'm like, you're coming across very judgmental. And I don't know that what you're saying is helping. I'm trying to bring this, it's like a fish. When you catch a fish, if you've ever gone fishing, you don't just get the bite and yank once. Sometimes you have to coax. Depends on what you're trying to catch. Depends on your bait. Depends on a few things. But sometimes you just got to ease into things. Sometimes you do jump in. But ultimately, what we're trying to do is save souls, getting the gospel out. So we've got to represent Jesus even online. Hebrews 9:24 is a great passage. The writer emphasizes that Christ has entered into heaven itself now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. That's what Jesus is doing. It was not that he was offering himself often or repeatedly, but as it is, he appeared once for all at the end of the ages to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. Not an animal. That's the whole point in Hebrews 10, that the blood of bulls and goats cannot take away sins. Jesus did this, but he did it once for all. And so he goes on in verse 27, and just as it is appointed for man to die once, just like Jesus died once, he doesn't keep on dying, he died once, for man it is appointed by God to die once, and after that comes judgment, so Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal or not to address sin, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him. It's that one time, but that's the point. Judgment's coming. I know there are some people in the world that really believe in what they call reincarnation. Nowhere in the Bible is reincarnation ever even introduced. I mean, there's not even a smattering of close to that at all. Even many of the doctrines that are brought in, and I'm thinking in the Old Testament of their worship of idols, most all of that was still the worship of a god, and there was a judgment. I mean, there are still themes that you find, even in idolatrous worship, that are similar to the Bible, that there is a god, and he's going to judge you. You know, there are people like that. I have had great discussions with folks talking to them about that. Do you believe in God? Well, you know, I don't know. They'll say things like that. And you go, okay. I was walking a couple days ago, and some guy, you know, just out of the blue, I mean, you walk, it's really kind of funny to me. Where we live, there's a little more than half a mile. It's 0.7. I've measured it just out of curiosity. But as I did that, you learn as people come up to you, you know, they, if it's the first time you come on the path, you acknowledge each other. Good morning, hello, how are you doing, whatever. You keep walking, but you say something, you look at them. The next time you walk in on them, you know, it might be the other time you're around, we don't even acknowledge each other. I've learned that. I thought it was great, everybody's saying good morning, and then I keep saying good morning, and one guy said, look, we already said good morning once. And that's what he said. I'm like, well, I guess he's right, we have, we don't need to keep doing it. I thought, Friendlyville, nope. And that was fine, I've learned the rule. But this guy just blurts out, how long is this? I'm like, how long is what? The path here. I'm like, 0.7. And the only reason I know is I measured it because I thought it was longer than a half mile. And I was just curious how much I've been walking. And that's all. Well, we got into a discussion. And after a while, he asked what I did. And I said, I'm a preacher, which usually people go run away. His response was, I'm a believer too, I think. And I'm like, okay, well, we'll start with that. And we did. We talked for 5 or 6 minutes. It wasn't a real long discussion, but where I found, I thought, a little bit of success is just asking him if he believed in God. Yes, I think so. Do you believe in judgment? Do you believe in right and wrong? Let's just talk that way. Yeah, I believe in right and wrong. Well, how do you determine what's right and wrong? Is it just how you feel today? Well, no, I think there's something more to it than that. I think you're right. It is more to it than that. The world we live in, though, it's feelings. How do I feel about this? Who cares how you feel? Why is right and wrong determined by how you feel? Because tomorrow you may wake up and have different feelings. Feelings are not good. We may all say, well, my feelings don't change. They all change. I mean, it's just the way it is. So there has to be a standard. Where are we going to find that standard? And ultimately, you want to lead people to the Word. Because ultimately, the Word tells us like this. Christ died once. He was offered to bear the sins of many, and he is going to appear a second time, and he's not going to deal with sin. He is going to save those who eagerly wait for him, because judgment's coming. Judgment is coming. 1 Corinthians 11. Let's look at this passage. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 27 through 32. This is in partaking of the Lord's Supper mindset. Paul is addressing their problems. He says, when y'all get together, you're not partaking of the Lord's Supper. What you're doing is not that. You may call it that, but that's not what you're doing. Verse 17 is where it starts. We're not going to read all of this, but in verse 17, in the following instructions, I don't commend you. I'm not telling you you're doing the right thing, because when you come together, it is not for the better, but for the worse. They were making things worse. Some of them were getting there and having a feast of all feasts, and leaving full and drunk, and some were leaving hungry. And he says, that's just not what was supposed to happen. So in verse 23, I received from the Lord what I delivered to you. God told me, and I'm telling you, what he did the night he was betrayed. He took bread. He said, this is my body, which is for you. And then he says in verse 27, whoever therefore eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner. And that means we can do it that way. We can do it in an unworthy way. What, though, is the consequence? You will be guilty concerning the body and blood of the Lord. So how do we not do that? Well, he says in verse 28, let a person examine himself, and so eat of the bread and drink of the cup. Examination. It's not me taking it and going, when is this going to be done? Or me taking it and going, boy, I can't believe so-and-so is participating in this at all. This is self-examination time. It's one of the most important things about the Lord's Supper. Again, you can take it in an unworthy way. You're going to be guilty then. But if you examine yourself and eat that way, you're not going to be guilty. Verse 29, anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body. Discerning means we're determining what's going on here with it. And, excuse me, let me pick it up again. Without discerning the body, it eats and drinks judgment on himself. He's going to make it just worse. That's why, notice what Paul says here in verse 30. That's why many of you are weak, and he's not talking about physical weakness, it's spiritual, and ill, and some have died. Why do some leave the Lord? You know, we'll say things like, well, they left the church. That's an inaccurate statement. They left the Lord. That's why they left the church. The church is a group of people, but they left the Lord first. It may be some people stay with the church, leaving the Lord. That's not our place to determine anyway. It's hard to do that. I mean, that's what I'm trying to get at. We can't look at somebody and go, brother, you look like you've left the Lord. I know you're here all the time. That's just not what you do, you know. But if someone leaves, we sit back going, well, what's wrong? Well, ultimately, their love for the Lord's just not there. They need to rekindle that love. That's what Jesus said in Revelation 2 to the Ephesian church. You've left your first love. Okay. So in 1 Corinthians 11, he's saying that you need to judge yourselves. You need to examine yourselves. That's why some of you are weak and ill. Some have died. But if we, notice verse 31, if we judged ourselves truly, which is what he says in verse 28, it's the same thing. Examine yourself. Here in verse 31, it's the same context. He says it a little differently. Judge yourself. It's the same thing. And if we did so truly, which means we can do it in an inaccurate way, a bad way, then we would not be judged. But when we're judged by the Lord through this, then we're disciplined so that we may not be condemned along with the world. So when we partake of the Lord's Supper, there is a judgment against us. Why did Jesus die? Ultimately, we say sin. Isn't that what John said? John the Baptist declared, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." Okay. Mozart, of all people, was kind of like a Samson. He was a believer in God's existence. He just didn't live a very good life. Really didn't. Kind of a debauchery sort of guy, you know. But he actually has a statement in his autobiography where he says, "Jesus, I thank you that you came to the earth to die for me." And it's a great statement because he's right. But he's right because that applies to me and that applies to you. Jesus died for me. He died for you. He died for all. And if we don't examine ourselves the way we're supposed to as we partake of the supper, it's not doing us any good. We're actually drinking and eating condemnation to ourselves. That's why we need to take that seriously. And that's how we're disciplined by the Lord. Which the writer of Hebrews says in Hebrews 12:6, the Lord disciplines the one he loves, chastises every son whom he receives. And he goes on to make the argument, if there is no discipline, you're not loved. I mean, that's just the simplicity of it. And ultimately, I think we need to understand, this life is not all there is. What do people sometimes say? You only have one life to live. That's not true. You have one life to live under the sun. If we die to sin in baptism, we're born again. That's what Jesus said, born again of water and spirit. Romans 6, he talks about dying, being buried, and being raised, just like Jesus. If we do that, then we're not going to die the second death. We will live a second life, an eternal life. This life is not all there is. And I know there are a lot of people who don't really want to think about that. They'd rather just say, this is the only life. This life is precious. So they don't want to be judged about anything. That's kind of what it is. It's not just live and let live. It's like the attitude I shared recently. When I was growing up, that's what a lot of people said. Live and let live. It seemed, you know, not so hard. But then now it's, I'm going to live my life and you're going to accept it. It doesn't matter what I do. It doesn't even matter how I do it. You're going to accept me because it's me. TV commercials sometimes really get me upset. There's one when some lady makes the declaration, I am proud of myself. Okay. You could take it at face value, or you can think, because it was all connected to Pride Month. Why? You know, why is one person determining the rest of the world and how the rest of the world is and isn't? There's no sense of community. There's no sense of larger than me. It's all about me. Well, with 7.5 billion people who are all about themselves, we wonder why the world is the way it is. I'll tell you. Because there's a lot of selfishness. And a lot of violence in that selfishness. Look with me over in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Paul deals with the body that comes. I know for the Corinthians, this was difficult. I know we don't really think about this too often, but the Corinthians actually argued that there was no resurrection. Not all of them did, but there were enough of them that Paul dealt with the issue in this letter. Early in the chapter, he says, "How can some of you say that there's no resurrection?" That blows his mind. In Acts 17, you remember Paul is at Mars Hill, the Areopagus, and he preaches the resurrection. And that's what catches the attention of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. This whole idea of the resurrection catches their attention. They want to know more about that. They had heard that one before. They really wanted to know more. So in Corinth, which I know is not Athens, but it's in the same general area of the world. It is, you know, Achaia. It's in this area. But they don't believe in the resurrection, some of them. And Paul deals with that, that if there is no resurrection, then Jesus died and stayed dead. He didn't rise. And if he didn't rise, then we have no hope. We're still caught in sin. And so in verse 35, he makes the argument, someone is going to ask, how are the dead raised? I mean, here's the question. You're talking about this resurrection, Paul. I want to know more about how they're raised, which is an argument that they're not raised. How are they raised, Paul? Paul says, well, I don't know. Actually, he says he does know through the inspiration of the Spirit. And this is what he says, you foolish person, what you sow doesn't come to life unless it dies. His argument is succinct, it's direct. The question you're asking is a foolish question. Because what you sow is not the same thing as what you reap. We all know that. I mean, we think, well, you sow the watermelon seed, you're going to get a watermelon. Yes, you are. But you can't look at a watermelon seed and say it's the same as the fruit. You got that thin, small, black thing that you put into the ground, and it comes out a bulbous green thing that you cut open, and it's red inside. We just know the watermelon seed produces a watermelon, apples, apple trees, and so on. We know all that, but you don't look at a seed and go, I see exactly how the fruit, you just don't. They don't look the same. It's fascinating. Paul makes that argument. What you sow doesn't come to life unless it dies. What you sow, verse 37, is not the body that is to be. It's a kernel. Perhaps wheat, maybe some other grain. God is going to give it a body as he has chosen. And he goes on talking in that way. Every kind of seed has its own body. And he makes that argument. In verse 42, it is the same with the resurrection of the dead. What you sow is perishable. What is raised is imperishable. It is sown in dishonor, but is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, raised in power. I'm going to step back and ask the question philosophically, I guess. What other world religion answers the question about purpose in life, truly? I mean, an atheist doesn't have an answer for why there's any good thing at all. They come at us, don't they, and say, you know, if there was this God you talk about who loved people at all, there would be no evil at all. Their argument is not a very good one. Biblically, it's not. Ananias and Sapphira, God dealt with their sin, did he not? Killed them both. What about Nadab and Abihu? They sinned against God and God killed them both. If that's the way the atheist says, if there's a God, that's how he would deal with all evil, then there would be no one. I know I've said that many times, but we've got to get that into the other mind of the person who says there's no God. I've had people, I don't know how I got the argument. I know it was not new to me. None of this is, obviously. But I remember hearing somebody talk to somebody else. I don't remember who the somebody was. That's why I'm being general that way. But they were like, there's no God because there's evil. And they came right back at him and said, then explain good at all. What's your favorite? What do you like to eat? Oh, I love chocolate chip cookies. How can you explain the good in tasting something, smelling something, seeing beautiful things? How can we explain any good thing? Concepts of love, concept of good, concept of justice. How can you explain that if there is no God? And you can't. You can't say, well, the whole universe is chaotic and evil, but here, look at all the good. Just doesn't make any sense. And yet this is what God has done. So in verse 45, it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being. the last Adam, which is a reference to Jesus, became a life-giving spirit. But it is not the spiritual that comes first. It is the physical or the natural, then the spiritual. The first man was coming from the earth, a man of dust. That's exactly what Genesis tells us. The second man is from heaven. Verse 48 says, as was the man of dust, so also are those made of dust. And as is the man of heaven, so also are those who are of heaven. And just as we've carried the image of the man of dust, we will bear the image of the man of heaven. And then notice what he says in verse 50, that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, which means the spiritual is what this is all leading to. And that's what I'm saying. This life is not all there is. And that's why Jesus says what he says in Matthew 12 and verse 35 through 37 about watching what we say. And we're going to be judged even over the idle words or the careless words we speak. And that's why he says that we've got to be careful about the fruits. I mean, that's what he's saying here. In, again, Matthew 12, 35, the good person out of the good treasure brings forth good. The evil person from evil treasure brings forth evil. I tell you, on the day of judgment, people will give account for every careless word they speak. So by your words, you'll be justified, and by your words, you'll be condemned. Let's see what time it is. I do this where I have a tendency of length. We got time. Look in Luke 12. You're probably thinking, no, we don't. Yes, we do. Luke 12. Sorry. Luke 12. And we're going to read a lot of this. I know it looks weird, divided, but this is by paragraph. And this is one of those great chapters. We're not going to read everything here. But in verses 1 through 3, we have the declaration of being aware of and being wary of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. And he says that in verse 1. And then in verse 2, he tells us why. Because nothing is covered up that's not going to be revealed. Nothing. I love it when TV shows, movies have these top secret things going on and the whole world, you know, doesn't know the top secret. Or even better, the news items, the headlines, top secret base revealed. And you're like, well, apparently it wasn't top secret. Apparently, because we all now know about it because you got it in a headline and pictures of it. Come on. It's just one of those things that always kind of gets under my skin when somebody does that. But the TV shows with all this secret stuff, it's still just really not that secret. Maybe you don't know where everything is. Maybe there is a little bit of a mystery, but there's still the three things that we all deal with, which is in 1 John 2:15, the sins of the eyes, the flesh, and the sinful pride of life. I mean, that's pretty much the summary of it all. So here in Luke 12, 3, Jesus concludes, therefore, whatever you've said in the dark, so beware of the Pharisees and their hypocrisy, because everything's going to be revealed, so you need to be careful what you say in the dark. That's Matthew 12, because it's going to be heard in the light. Whatever you whisper in private rooms is going to be proclaimed on the housetops. One of my college teachers says, can you imagine you're in a room and you whisper to somebody? Something, you know, 2 plus 2 is 4. You know, it's a secret. And some guy's on your roof, hey everybody, 2 and 2 are 4. What in the world, you know? It seems a little weird, but can you imagine actual things that we whisper, that are proclaimed? That's what Jesus says is going to happen. And immediately he gets into this. I tell you, my friends, verse 4, don't fear the one who can kill the body, and after that, he cannot do anything else. Fear the one who kills the body and has the authority to cast your soul into hell. He goes on in verse 9, talking about acknowledging him. And those who deny him are going to be denied before the angels of God. And in verse 10, everyone who speaks a word against the Son of Man is going to be forgiven, but the one who blasphemes against the Spirit will not be forgiven. And then he says in verse 13, we read that someone cries out about dividing the inheritance with him. And Jesus tells the parable about the man who has eye trouble, right? He's thinking only about himself, all the stuff he's got, and how much he thinks he's got, and then he dies. And now his soul has to go before God in judgment. That's in verse 20. God said, you fool, this very night your soul is required of you. And the things you've prepared, whose now will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. I read most of an article. There is this soccer player, and he's Somalian. He's extremely wealthy because of his skills at soccer. But that is, his critics are critical because he's not buying jets and cars and houses because that's what rich people do. And he's like giving his money back to his villages, to the surrounding area where he was raised, because he's like, I don't need that much money. It's amazing to me that people would ever criticize somebody who's generous. But they are. They're like, you're living in kind of a shack compared to your buddies. And he's like, yeah, because I have a roof over my head. I'm fine, you know. I don't drive a big car because I don't need a big car. I just have a car. I'm letting other people enjoy my wealth. This guy apparently wasn't that way either. He would be critical, would he not? Can't believe you're not keeping it all to yourself, buying bigger things and better things. And then verse 22, he said to his disciples, so therefore, that word therefore means this statement is connected to the one previously. The one previously is verse 21, here is the one who lays a treasure for himself and he's not rich toward God. Therefore, I tell you, don't be anxious about your life, what you're going to eat, what you're going to wear, or what you're going to put on. Life is more than food and the body is more than clothing. And this is more familiar to us from Matthew's account, but it's the same thing. And then he says in verse 32, fear not, little flock. It is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions, give to the needy, provide yourselves with money bags that don't grow old. In other words, lay up treasure in heaven, not here on earth. With a treasure in the heavens that doesn't fail, where no thief approaches, there's no moth to destroy. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And that's what we're wanting. We're wanting the treasure that doesn't fade. And we see here, I mean, I got to tell you, I had a friend either yesterday or the day before. Days roll into each other sometimes, but he hadn't heard that I had had the heart attack. He just heard, and he says, I can't believe you went through all that. And I wrote back and just said, yeah, it was something. And that's pretty much what I said. He wrote back, well, now what are you going to do? And I told him, I said, my first inkling is to go learn how to fly. Honestly, that's what I want to do. My wife has said no. Okay, but that's what I want to do. I mean, I would love to go fly. There are a few things I'd like to go do, and they all sound dangerous to some people. And he came back. He says, no, seriously, what are you going to do? He said, because God seems to have given you a second lease on life, is what we say. And I told him, I said, I have thought about it, and it upsets me thinking about it, and I don't mind trying to tell you this, but I don't know why. I was spared. I don't know the answer to it. I don't think it's because I'm an awfully, good guy, great guy. I'm not trying to do the false humility thing. It's just kind of when you do your own self-examination, your self-judgment, it's like there's really no reason. I'm not solving world hunger. I'm not doing anything on a worldwide scale at all. But when you step to think back and start saying, yeah, I've been given a new opportunity, maybe more of an opportunity, what now? And ultimately, I think of the what now being in a lot of different directions, but ultimately, sounds kind of cliche, I want to give glory to God. And to do that, there are things I feel like I need to be doing. It's like the guy who's on the beach. Y'all probably heard the illustration, read the illustration. It's a familiar one. They're a bunch of beached starfish. They do this sometimes. They get caught in by the tide, and they're beached. They can't swim or claw their way right back into the water. They barely move, you know? By the way, how many of y'all knew that starfish are scavengers? Probably some of you do. I mean, it's one of those things I've read before and forgot. There was a picture on YouTube. I say a picture, a video on YouTube. If you look it up, the starfish colony. There's a dead fish on the bottom of the ocean, and the starfish, you have to do it fast, and they do. They speed up the whole thing, but these starfish come up on that dead carcass and eat it. And then they disappear. And it blew my brain. I'm watching it going, I didn't know that's what they did. I may have read that before, but I've watched that video, and it really is something. So don't worry if you die at the bottom of the ocean. Starfish going to be eating you up. Not going to be left. I'm not kidding. It's really cool. Don't die at the bottom of the ocean. That seems kind of weird. But so here are the starfish, beached. And some kid's throwing them back into the water. And, of course, there's always the critic who stands nearby and says, you can't save them all. And the kid goes, you're right, but I just saved that one. And I think sometimes that's what Satan tries to do. He's the critic. You can't save everybody. And he's right, you can't. But I'm trying to save that one. Maybe the one's me. Maybe the one is more than me. Noah. This is another thing at the Southern Baptist Convention that is sad. There's a guy by the name of Rick Warren. He's a very familiar, if you've read anything. Rick Warren had some really popular books. I've got a couple of them on my own bookshelf. And there are some good biblical ideas that he's put out. Spirit-driven life, that's one of them. It's very popular. But at the Southern Baptist Convention, he stood in front of a crowd and listed all the people he had saved. Thousands, he said. He baptized thousands here, thousands here. And because of my books, I have saved. And that's how he was saying it. Oh, he did all that. And there were a lot of people who were critical, I think justified. No man saves another man. We preach. What does Paul say? Plant, water, God gives increase. Who gives increase? God does. Rick Warren doesn't. Jamie Hines doesn't. No man can do that. And it came across extremely arrogant. And I think that was the thing that bothered me. It was just like, okay, he's had an influence. That's great. But to go on and on about how great he is, how dare any of us? Noah came to mind. Because Noah didn't save the generation of people he preached to for 120 years. He saved himself and his wife and his kids and their wives. That's it. Eight people. I guess according to Rick Warren, that just wasn't enough, right? I've saved thousands. I've baptized. Yeah, okay, that's great. And maybe ultimately we think of this. You can't judge me. And we may say that sometimes. And you're right. And I don't even think it's my place to try. But there is one who's going to judge us all. And his judgment is going to be perfect. And his judgment is going to be permanent. I think that's what we need to understand. It's not just perfect judgment. It's going to be permanent judgment. We're either going to be in heaven because we have been justified by the grace of God, or we're going to be condemned to an eternity in hell. When I was growing up, one of the things I hated to hear from my dad when I got the lecture, you know, whenever that came, which it came often, honestly, when I was growing up, I reminded my dad, I told y'all we were talking about different things, how I learned to swim and whatever. I told Dad, I said, you know, when I was growing up, I got lectures a lot. Mark didn't. I said, Mark didn't even get spankings. He goes, yeah, because he was good. Okay, can't argue with that too much, really can't. But a lot of the lectures that came from Dad, we'd sit there and he'd just sit there, which I hated. I'd rather just get spanked and have the thing over with. But we'd sit there and he'd say things like, I'm not going to judge you on this, but God's going to judge you. You got to think about those things. His judgment's going to be perfect. His judgment's going to be permanent. And then I had to sit there and think about it. Have you ever probably heard one of your parents, I don't know where somebody learned this, you stay in your room until you've thought about this. You come out only after you've thought about it. It doesn't take me long to think. I may not be a good thinker, but it doesn't take me long to think. I come right back out of the room. And I remember Mom and Dad a few times, you get back in there, you haven't thought long enough. Thoughts are like lightning, right? They go quick. I remember saying that one time. One time. I got in big trouble for that. So as we close, I do want to remind us what Paul says to the Athenians. These times of ignorance God overlooked, which is saying a lot to Epicurean and Stoic philosophers who sat around and that's all they did was think about things. But now he is commanding all people everywhere to repent. Paul's statement isn't a point in, you know, a finger pointed in their face. He just says God has overlooked these times of ignorance. He now is commanding all people everywhere to repent. And the reason why he tells us is because he's fixed a day. Even Jesus says he doesn't know when, but God the Father has fixed a day in which he's going to judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he's appointed. And of this he's given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. I know we may think about the resurrection of Jesus about salvation, and it is directly connected to salvation, but it's also directly connected by what Paul says here, to judgment. Jesus' resurrection is directly connected to judgment. God has assured us all he's going to judge everybody through his Son, and he shows that by raising him from the dead. And so, judgment needs to be righteous. Don't judge by appearances. That was what we were talking about earlier when we got to Matthew 7. Excuse me. I didn't mean to go too far with that. Don't judge by appearances. Judge righteous judgment. Things may appear good or bad. I don't know about you. There are some things I read in the Bible I wouldn't judge the way they are judged. For example, Samson. Samson seems not to be a very religiously minded person, but he's in Hebrews 11 as a man to emulate in his faith. That shows that God's judgment, again, is perfect. And we want to stand before Him perfected in His Son. The song that we have is a song of encouragement, number 572. As we sing this, consider your own soul. Consider, as you stand before God in judgment, what is your answer going to be when He speaks to you about all the secret things nobody else may even know about? He does. Again, His righteousness will be clear. His judgment will be perfect and permanent. If you've not been baptized, you're not saved. You have no hope until you are baptized, born again of water and Spirit, because that's what Jesus said. And it's the same for everybody. It's not like you are being pointed out because you haven't been. It's the fact that this is an accessible salvation to everyone. Jesus came and died for everyone. Everyone has hope only in Him. He is our only hope. But He's everyone's only hope. What Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through Me. He's ready. We're ready. If you want to be baptized, please come forward as we stand and sing.